This is another iRaw podcast.
To me, intelligence is a way of responding to environmental change. So it's a question of behavioural flexibility, of being able to adapt to new circumstances. And koalas are actually able to adapt quite readily to new environments. We have koalas in the Adelaide Hills are currently moving down into the city, so which is quite remarkable for a species that's highly adapted to eucalypt forests. They're actually moving into the parklands. They're moving along river systems and learning to live in very human modified environments, which is a really interesting behavior and a very recent one. And it doesn't happen in any of the other cities. So there's lots of interesting things going on that we don't give them credit for because they don't look and sound and behave like us.
Welcome back to the Animal Turn, everyone. This is another bonus episode. Once again, I'm going to be doing a bit of a book review, but instead of focusing on a concept in today's episode, we're going to be focusing on a specific animal. Today, we're going to be speaking and learning all about koalas. Now, prior to today's episode, I really did not know much about koalas. I read Danielle's book and I learned so much, not only about koalas, but about the kind of ecology and history of Australia. And it was really a fascinating journey. And in today's episode, we speak about everything koala. We talk about koalas' bodies, their reproduction, some of their social dynamics. We talk about some of the environmental stresses that they're facing. It really is a great episode where we cover a whole host of dynamics related to koalas. But let me tell you a little bit about Danielle before you head over to the episode. Danielle Claude is a zoologist, biologist, natural history author, and animal expert based at Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia. Her new book, Koala, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future, the one we're talking about today, is really an amazing journey into the hidden life of the koala, revealing what life is like up in the trees. She stitches together incredible stories of koalas with expert insights, as well as everyday kind of observations of koalas. Danielle has written a whole host of books related to natural history, including The Wasp and the Orchid, The Woman Who Sailed the World, and Voyages in the South Seas, among many, many others. We had a really great time chatting to one another. Before you head over to the episode, I also just want to say thank you once again to the sponsors of this show. Thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. Hi, Danielle. Welcome to the Animal Turn podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. I've just finished reading your book, literally just finished reading it before we got here. It got to me, I think it got a little bit lost. I think your book went on a journey and I got it and I've just like read it intensely for the last week. So I'm thinking very much about koalas, which is not an animal I've thought much about before. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about them today. Have you always been interested in koalas?
Well, I guess koalas are something that's, you know, as an Australian, they're such a well-known and identifiable animal that they're kind of always in the background. You know, they're popular children's toys. They pop up in children's storybooks and as icons for sporting teams and those sorts of things. But, yeah, I don't think I'd ever really thought much about them in any detail. So yeah, the book was quite a different approach for me.
Yeah, it was quite interesting for me too. So coming from the social sciences, you know, I could see you approach this in a very different way to, I think, how I would have approached writing about koalas. Like each chapter seemed to kind of focus on particular body parts and then build up from there and what these body parts mean about the animal and their history. So I'm looking forward to getting into that a bit more during the episode. But before we do that, perhaps we could learn a little bit about you first. So how did you come to writing about koalas? What's your background?
Yeah, well, I've got a slightly unusual background. I did actually start in the humanities. So I started in doing an arts degree, but I majored in psychology. But the subject that I particularly liked in psychology was actually animal behaviour. So I had one lecturer who was very keen on animal behaviour, and you know, in psychology that can often be a lot about rats, but he broadened it out to talk about all different species, and we even did dinosaur behaviour. So he's a very broad-ranging academic, and I realised that I was really fascinated by animals. So when I came to do my PhD, I again wanted to do animal behaviour, But that wasn't done in the psychology department. It was done in the zoology department of that university. So I kind of slid sideways into zoology as a postgraduate. So
how was that slide? moving, like how you make it sound seamless, but how was it starting a PhD in zoology, going from psychology to zoology? How was that?
I don't think I realized at the beginning how much I didn't know. So it wasn't until I was really at the write-up stage that I suddenly thought, oh, wow, this is actually a really big step. But to be honest, it really set me up really well for becoming a writer, which is what I've pretty much done ever since I finished my PhD. I've worked in science communication, and every book I write is a little bit like starting a new PhD, a new topic. So I always know a little bit about it, but I'm always wanting to know more. The reason I write books is to find out more about the topic. So that was really good training for me, I think, that being willing to immerse myself in a new field and know where to find the information I need and who to ask and who to talk to and how to check and make sure I've got stuff right.
Yeah, I think it's an incredible combination. I think of the guests I've had on the show who have had kind of this combination of, you know, physical and social sciences and just a keen interest in writing seem to do amazing things. The episode just before you is Jules Howard. I've had Jonathan Balcom on. And these are just, I think, Carl Safina, really incredible examples of how you can start to blend writing to bring, you know, animals forward and to really tell their stories in interesting ways. So what an incredible journey. So this is the first time you've written about koalas. You've never done a project on koalas before until you decided to start writing this book?
No, I haven't had much to do with koalas before. I've written a little about them in some of my earlier fossil books. So I've written a little bit about koala fossils, but not a great deal. But I guess, you know, I live in an area that's got the highest population of koalas in the country. I live in the Adelaide Hills, and there's a translocated population that's established here. And they're really quite abundant. Koalas are really quite rare to see in the wild. They're very widely dispersed animals. But in the Adelaide Hills, it's not uncommon to come across one on the side of the road, sitting in the middle of the road, in a tree. You hear them bellowing in the springtime. So here they're a little bit more at the forefront, I think, of people's minds than they might be in other parts of the country.
They're a bit more usual where you live than where I live. And it's quite, so I'm from South Africa, and I know that coming to Canada and studying here, I realized how much of the wildlife that was just around me I took for granted, how completely different a space is and my interactions with particular wildlife, or my like non-interactions, if that makes sense. You just know that they're there. But for us who don't know much about Australia or Australian animals, because reading about marsupials now was quite, like, my mind was blown several times learning about marsupials and just how different they are to mammals, but also how similar they are in different ways. So could you give us like biology 101? What is a marsupial?
So a marsupial is a mammal as well. There's two major groups of mammals. There's the marsupials and there's the eutherian or placental mammals, which is what we are. So the marsupials are essentially the pouched mammals. So they have a different reproductive system. That's what distinguishes them. And they give birth to extremely young babies. So at a very early stage of development. So while we have a very prolonged pregnancy and incubate our babies internally, our marsupials pop them out quite early. So when they're just a tiny little jelly bean. So they're not much more than a mouth and a pair of front legs. And the front legs, you know, help them crawl up into the pouch where they have a sort of an external pregnancy, which personally I think is a fantastic reproduction system. I think we really dipped out and doing this internal thing and having to pop out a huge baby at the end.
It's quite remarkable. So what, because the placenta with us keeps us kind of, it's a food system, right? I guess between mother and child, it's a food system in a way to kind of share nutrients. So here, before the jelly bean pops out, what's going on inside? Like, so there's a womb, but it's not a placenta womb?
Oh, I couldn't answer that. That's outside my realm of expertise. I do know a lot of people who know an awful lot about reproductive biology of marsupials because it is so unusual and amazing. I know they've got two wombs, but
they've got two wombs.
So that's the didelphus of the pun of the scientific name of the some of the family is they've got two wombs, and they. I guess the interesting thing after they're born is that when they come out, they crawl up into the mother's pouch and they attach themselves very, very firmly to the nipple. So they really can't be removed from the nipple without damage. So it's almost like they're stuck on. And early biologists actually thought that they had grown out of the nipple into the mother's pouch, almost like a budding process. So they were very confused about that, but actually they just hang on so tight that you can't get them off.
Incredible. So they attach to the nipple, and then they just, do they like 24/7 they stay attached?
Yes. So for several months they stay attached. So I guess that's kind of like, you know, the alternative to the placenta is using that lactation system to finish their growth. So essentially when they leave the pouch, it's like a second birth. So, you know, it's a second. So that's then when the animal leaves the pouch, that's the equivalent of when mammals like us would give birth to their young, and they're much more independent. They still need a lot of protection and care, but they're a lot more independent.
And there are a lot more marsupials than, I mean, I think when I think of marsupials, I think kangaroos and koalas, pretty much. But there are a lot more marsupials in Australia than that. Like, and I love the names of them. They've got really fascinating names, like gliders and wombats. And so, how many marsupials, or how many types of marsupials are there?
Yeah. So there are a lot. I mean, marsupials are particularly abundant in the southern hemisphere, and you know they're a Gondwanan group. So there's a lot of marsupials in South America, and there's also a lot of marsupials in Australia, but they tend to be absent from other areas. So the placental or eutherian mammals dominate in the old world countries, if you like, that are connected through Africa, Asia, and into North America, where obviously those placental mammals. North America would also have had a lot of marsupials, but the land bridge to Europe and Asia would have brought a whole heap of placental mammals down. So that's the reason why we've got a lot of marsupials. And Australia has a particularly diverse range, because Australia is the most isolated of all the continental land masses except for Antarctica. So Antarctica and Australia have been on their own for a very long time without any contact with other land masses. So their original fauna has diversified into all these remarkable forms. So while the marsupials of South America, they're quite diverse, but they're all opossums. So, you know, that they're sort of all of that type. And there's you know, 100 or more odd opossums in South America. So there's a lot of them there too, which I had no idea of before I started this book. But Australia has the greatest diversity of, you know, physiologically different forms. If you think we have some of the tiniest little, we've got tiny little planigales, which are tiny little shrew-like animals with a completely flattened head that live in the cracks between the mud plains, and they're voracious little carnivores. They eat insects, and they're ferocious little tiny beasts. So they're just super amazing. And right up to the big red kangaroos, you know, which we're very familiar with, which are really, really distinctively unusual-looking animals. They're bipedal hopping. And then we have the gliders. We have marsupial moles that swim through sand. So the diversity of body form and shape and adaptation is quite remarkable. And that's really what makes the marsupials such an important group of animals, because they give us a completely independent line of evolution to look at mammal evolution. The things they do that are similar to or different from the northern hemisphere mammals that we're mostly more familiar with give us some real insights into what's going on in evolution, mammal evolution and behavior.
Are there other types of mammals that are divided by reproduction? So you've got placental mammals and these marsupial mammals. Are there others?
But there's one other group, and that's the monotremes, which are also Australian. And so that's the echidna and the platypus. And they're a different group again, because they're egg-laying mammals. So they're the two species that lay eggs and also suckle their young. So they're kind of the weirdest ones of the lot. But there's basically only those three groups.
Incredible. So you spoke a fair bit there about evolution, and it was quite clear throughout your book that you've got quite an interest in fossils. And so you spoke a moment ago kind of about your background in psychology and then zoology, but where did the training to read fossils come in, or to look at fossils? Or is that an interest of yours, or are you trained in that?
No, I'm not specifically trained in that. So I do rely a lot on my paleontologist friends to assist me in getting that right. And learning to read paleontology papers is quite a skill. They're not the easiest papers in the world to read. But I guess I started that from some early work. One of my early jobs when I finished my PhD was in the Museum of Victoria. So I was employed. It was a dream job for me, in actual fact, because I was employed as an essayist. My job was actually to write stories about museum collections, which was just an amazing position to be given.
That sounds like a pretty great position.
Yes, it's actually a lot of my books come from that time, the stories that I discovered in that. So that gave me an insight into natural history collecting and paleontology, because a lot of that work is often done out of museums. And I was asked by the museum publishing wing to write a book on megafauna, because there wasn't a book written on Australian megafauna. And when we think about megafauna, most people will think about, you know, woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers, all those sorts of things. The typical, you know, the giant sloths, the those sorts of animals. But because we are a continent that's full of marsupials, we didn't have any of those types of animals. We have giant marsupials. So we have giant diprotodons, which are a relative of the koala, but was more like a kind of a giant bear, if you like, but a grazing herbivore, so probably a fairly amiable creature. But it was the size, you know, 2 or 3 tons, the size of a small four-wheel drive car, and there were great herds of them roaming around the inland of Australia. And they had their young tucked in a pouch under their belly, these giant animals.
When did they go extinct?
So they mostly went extinct, you know, the same sort of megafaunal extinction phase about 60,000 years ago. You know, there was a giant possum-like animal, but it was actually a carnivore. So it lived in the trees, was a bit like a leopard, I guess. It would ambush predator with great big slicing teeth and a retractable thumb to grab hold of things with. So really some amazing animals.
Wasn't there a wolf of sorts? But I think the wolf went extinct more recently, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's the thylacine. So it's also called the Tasmanian tiger. So it was widespread across Australia, but retreated to Tasmania probably with the arrival of dingoes, which are a recent addition. That, you know, they've only been here for 4,000 or 5,000 years. So it was still abundant in Tasmania, but it was basically hunted to extinction by European settlers when they arrived, because they thought it was going to eat their sheep.
Wow. Yeah, a lot of killing has been done in the name of sheep in many continents, I think. So koalas, have they always been in Australia? How did they come to be in Australia? In kind of the view of this long history, where do koalas getting to Australia come in? Or, yeah, how do they emerge?
Well, I guess, they have always been here, I guess. You know, they're part of the original marsupial fauna. The time at which they become obvious in the fossil, so the time they become distinctive as koalas, which is a tricky concept to grasp, we basically identify them from their teeth. So they have a very particular type of tooth, and teeth are the things that we have. The fossil record in Australia is not great because it's a very old country, and because of the erosion, we just don't have good conditions for fossilisation. So usually the things we have left are the teeth, because they're the hardest part of the skeleton. So koala teeth had been found back 24 million years ago. So they have been around pretty much, interestingly, as long as eucalypt forests have been around. So they appear around the same time as the eucalypt, the characteristic eucalypt trees that modern koalas feed on. It's not to say that the ancient koalas also fed on them. They may have eaten other leaves, but they are definitely leaf eaters as well.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
Well, this is an important part of koala stories, is kind of the story of eucalyptus trees in general. And one of the points you make in the book is just the wide variety of eucalyptus trees there are. So again, coming from South Africa, I'm very kind of familiar with blue gums. At least I think that's what I just called every big tree I saw. I was like, it's a blue gum. But I don't think I thought much more about it. Reading some of your work here, I had no idea that there was just such a wide variety of eucalyptus, and that koalas are really picky about the eucalyptus leaves they eat.
Yeah, look, the eucalyptus story is a whole nother story. And as you say, you're very familiar with blue gums. Blue gums are one of Australia's best exports, in fact. You know, they're the reverse colonizers, that they have spread across the world. You know, people in California think that they're Californian blue gums, but of course they all come from Australia. And they're one of the most widespread plantation or, you know, planted hardwoods in the world. So a lot of people are familiar with them and other eucalypts as well that have also spread. But koalas, I think the interesting thing about koalas is that people tend to say, oh, they're very specialized. You know, it's no wonder they're going extinct because they only eat eucalypts, as if that was some sort of restrictive diet, when in actual fact, you know, eucalypts are the dominant forest of Australia. So they're our biggest forest areas, and they're also very hard to eat. Not very many animals can eat them. So koalas have been really clever, if you like, in choosing to specialise on that. But as you say, a eucalypt, we tend to think of eucalypts as all the one thing, but eucalypts are incredibly diverse. So there's up to 900 species and subspecies of eucalypts in Australia. So they've separated massively, largely because of oscillations in climate that separate different populations of eucalypts from one another. So it's created lots and lots of different individual pockets of eucalypts everywhere. So that makes it really hard for a species to actually adapt to individual eucalypts, because the different species have different toxins and different, you know, you have to have different ways of breaking them down. So koalas have evolved a really remarkable capacity to digest a wide range of eucalypts. They can't eat all 900 species. They only are known to eat about 70 species, and they're typically the most widespread ones. And any one koala tends to only eat between 3, 4, maybe up to 10 species of eucalypts. And the way we think they do that is by having a very specialized gut biome. So we are becoming more aware of the importance of the bacteria in our own digestive system for our digestive health. But for koalas, it really is a matter of life or death. They have to have very particular bacteria to help them break down the extremely tough, fibrous leaves of the eucalypts, and they inherit this from their mothers. So they basically are dosed up or inoculated by their mother with some of her gut biome, which is a fairly slightly revolting process, as you can imagine, but really important nonetheless. And it's one of those things with biology that people always say, oh, you biologists, you're always fascinated by droppings and poop.
I'm surprised we're not more obsessed with human poo. You know, I take Linus to the vet. Linus is my dog. And one of the first things the vet asks me is, how's his poo? Because it's a really good indicator of how he's doing. And I am very attentive to his poo. But I don't know if I've ever really had a doctor, when I just go for a GP checkup, be like, how's your poo? And I wonder if that shouldn't just be a standard question. I think we're quite divorced from our poo.
And you know, they used to, I know that I've heard stories of not the, of, you know, British royalty where they had the senior noble was responsible for checking the king's stools. So clearly in the past we have known the importance of
poop. Yeah, you explained though with the koalas, because I didn't, so the pouch, I think a lot of listeners will be aware of, or at least I was aware of the pouch, but the koalas have a different kind of pouch to other marsupials for exactly this reason, so that they can get to, what's the name of this?
The pap, yeah. It's called pap feeding. So what happens? It happens after the young has emerged from the pouch. So the young are already active and outside, but they're still feeding predominantly on milk, and they'll play with leaves, but they don't actually eat them. But at some point, the mother, she basically evacuates part. It's not actually the waste product. It's actually a special part of her digestive system. So it's the cecum, which in a human is called the appendix, and our appendix is about the size of our thumb. But the koala cecum is 1.5 meters or 2 meters long. It's a really long, big structure, and it's like it contains this microbial soup that they chew up all the leaves, and it gets washed into the cecum, and it sits there for quite a long time being digested and having the nutrients extracted out of it. So the mother, nobody really knows how this works, but at some point they turn off their normal digestive system and flush a big heap of this green, bright green soup out of their system, and the baby just goes berserk over this. It's very messy and it looks very revolting, but the young joeys absolutely love it. And once they've eaten that, they are then able to digest gum leaves and they start eating hard food. So that's the weaning process for a koala.
Wow, this is remarkable. So, I mean, just the several things that you've highlighted here with regards to koalas' bodies that, you know, adapt them well. So you spoke about the teeth, and the way you described the teeth as being quite like beautiful and jagged and sharp in quite distinctive ways. Now also the cecum and this really large kind of, is it part of the intestine or is it a completely separate organ?
No, it's part of the digestive tract, but it's kind of like it's like, you know, after the stomach, there's the cecum, and things can either, so the big particles of leaves that are too hard to digest get flushed straight through, and they turn into the hard little pellets that koalas produce a lot of, but the fine particles get washed into this soupy area, so into the cecum. So it's like a bag off to the side where they can hold this material for a longer time and digest it.
And this is what makes them really well adapted to eating eucalyptus leaves, because they're so toxic, and this allows them to kind of get, instead of...
Yeah, so the cecum allows them to digest them. They're very indigestible. They're just the same level of indigestibility as grass and stuff like that. So they're a low nutrient plant food that's got lots of, you know, complex waxes and difficult thing and fibers in the leaves. The toxins are dealt with by the liver, so the liver in a koala is quite big and complex, and it's also got a double dose of genes for removing toxins from the bloodstream. So it's particularly good at getting rid of those toxins in eucalypts. But having said that, there's still a lot of eucalypts that are too toxic even for koalas to eat. So there's a lot of trees that they won't eat, and for that reason they need to have a really, really big forest to support them. So one koala typically needs a forest the size of an average sports field to support it. So that's why they're so dispersed and not very frequently seen.
Incredible. So thank you so much. So we've got big livers, a cecum, we've got impressive teeth. I know that you speak about their thumbs being, two thumbs is pretty, are there any other animals that have two, because everyone, like when people talk about humans, we always tend to speak of us as being really important and impressive because we have thumbs, but yeah, koalas have two thumbs. So
yeah, they're twice as impressive.
Exactly. Are there any other animals that have like hands like koalas? They're really remarkable.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's several features of koalas' hands and feet that are similar to other marsupials. So on their feet, they have two of the digits are joined together. So they have a single two finger. It's a toe because it's on a foot, and it's got two claws that are stuck on the same one. So it's called syndactyly. And that's a real feature of marsupials. So marsupials are prone to do that. A lot of the possums have that. The kangaroos, if you think of their back feet, they've got fused, you know, digits that have gone into one big long toe with two little ones on the side, which is the big single-toed foot that they use. And they use the two claws for grooming. So that's like a little special comb for koalas. So they do have really interesting feet, but they do share some of those features in common. I'm not sure about other animals that have the two thumbs that are, but it's a very prehensile kind of form. So it allows them to grip better. You know, we use our thumb to grip against our fingers, and koalas have got two thumbs that enable them to do that. So their fingers are split into that kind of Vulcan gesture, if you like, with them like this. So
I've never been able to do that. My pinkies seem to be so far from my ring fingers. So it's just like my pinky goes on a journey and the rest of my hand is like, what are you doing? So koalas have really impressive bodies. There's a lot going on in, you know, what a lot of us would look at and say, oh, what a cute animal. But this is a sophisticated, well-adapted animal that knows how to, I think, survive in pretty harsh climates. But in terms of their social worlds and their social lives, you had some really, I think, touching stories in the book. And one that stuck out with me, hands down, I think, was that story. I think it was a friend of yours who saw a horse and a koala interacting. And could you tell us that story? Because I found it remarkable.
Yeah. So my friend breeds racehorses. And she's always out keeping an eye on them, you know, because especially when they're young, they can be a little bit silly and get themselves in trouble. And she noticed a koala. The young filly had gone over to investigate something in a tree, and it was a koala. And she was across the paddock, so she couldn't get to them very quickly. So she just watched to see what would happen. Of course, koalas have got really, really long, incredibly sharp claws. So even though they're not an aggressive species, they can inflict quite a bit of damage. So she was a little bit concerned about this. And when she just watched what happened, and the two animals basically just reached out noses, as you know, horses are prone to do, reach out and sniff something. And the koala also reached out and bumped noses, which is a typical greeting pattern for koalas. When they do approach one another under friendly circumstances, they bop their noses, which is the term a lot of people use for that. So they bump noses together, which is very cute. And so that's what this horse and the koala did. So it was a very amicable interaction.
Did the koala not also stroke? It sounded to me like they...
Yeah. I think young koalas in particular are known to be quite curious animals, so they do investigate things and investigate other animals. They don't have – I think the thing that's really distinctive about koalas is that they don't have a strong flight response in – I guess they're not fast animals. You know, they can't run away really quickly. They certainly move away from predators, and they can move reasonably quickly, but it's not their primary response. If you know, their primary predator response is to get up a tree and sit still and keep still. So that's how they respond. So they're not flighty animals the way, say, a deer or a horse is. Or, you know, there's lots of animals that if you're trying to get them to go somewhere they don't want to go, they're quite, you know, they bolt in the wrong direction. Koalas are less inclined to do that. They're more inclined to sit down and look at you and try and work out what you're up to in response to those situations. So I think that just gives them a slightly different approach to reacting to other animals, that they're just not that, they're not as flighty. So yeah, they do approach, we most commonly hear about them approaching humans because, you know, people notice that, but I'm sure that they must approach other animals, you know, quite a lot. There's been videos of them coming out of wombat burrows. I can't imagine how that interaction would go if they actually encountered a wombat down a burrow, because wombats, despite being koalas' closest living relative, are not very amiable animals. they're not very friendly at all, especially as adults. So I think the trouble is we don't spend much time looking at these animals and watching them for these interactions, so we don't really get to appreciate what their social interactions are. Koala interactions happen on a slow time frame, often at inconvenient times for us, usually, you know, in the middle of the night, in the middle of the bush, a long way from anywhere. So we just don't get that insight into what's happening. And I think they'd be a lot more interesting if we did, which is, I guess, what I was trying to achieve in the book. You know, you mentioned that I talk a lot about the animals' bodies. That was in part because I wanted to get away from the way we normally write about animals, which is, who was the first person to discover them? Who was the first person to name them? What do people think about these animals? I really wanted to try and get us away from our human-centered approach and really look at this animal from the animal's point of view. So I guess I was trying to embody the koala a little bit and get us inside their world as much as I possibly could before we engaged with humans. So that's why the humans come into the story at the end of the book more so than at the beginning of the book.
I definitely picked up on that, and I thought it was quite interesting because I know you do kind of speak about how human movements, whether it was indigenous populations or colonialism or most recent kind of, more recent changes in Australia, how those have impacted the populations of koalas. And it did come it did seem upside down, right, to how most books start. Like oftentimes the story will somehow seem to start often I think with colonial stories, and even that you put much further back, you put kind of indigenous stories ahead of that, and I definitely noticed that flow changed the narrative, it changed the way in which I've thought about koalas, because you started with them as animals and what their interests are, which I think was a really powerful move that I thought was quite successful. But I did enjoy when you started to kind of speak about their interactions and to disrupt the idea of sociality a little bit as well, because I think I've spoken about it before on the podcast. There's this kind of idea that somehow if animals are alone, they're not social, which I think is a bit of a misnomer, because they're just communicating in a way we don't necessarily understand. So could you maybe give us a little bit of an insight into some of the ways in which koalas communicate?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're certainly long distance communicators for sure. So the most obvious form of communication that we're aware of is their bellowing. So in the springtime, in fact, just the other night, even though it's not spring, it's completely the wrong time of year, I was woken up by a koala bellowing in the trees outside. So they have this really deep, throaty kind of grunting bellow that carries a long distance. In actual fact, it's very low, low frequency bellow, and that obviously communicates to a large number of, usually the males that do this, although females can also bellow. But so it communicates to others in the area, lets them know that there's a big tough brooding male in this area, and discourages other males from coming near, and also encourages interested females to come closer. so that's an important sort of social interaction. But perhaps probably a more important one is the chemical signals that they leave. So koalas typically, especially the males, rub themselves on the trees, or they wee on the trees and leave chemical traces, so that when a koala is wandering through the forest deciding which tree it wants to go up, they will typically sniff the tree first. And what it's doing is checking to see, is anybody else in this tree? Is it somebody, is it another koala that I want to, that I don't mind sharing a tree with? Or is it one that I want to avoid? So non-breeding females will avoid trees with males in them. Males will be very careful about approaching a tree with another male in it, unless they think they can battle it off. So there's an awful lot of communication going on without any direct contact between the animals. So I think the other thing I was trying to really get across with my book, and people did say, how come you keep talking about people and humans all the time? And it's like, because I want us to understand how we think like primates. We have a very primate-focused way of doing things. We've got busy brains and busy little fingers that like to poke and prod and fiddle with things and touch things, and our approach to understanding other animals is is shaped by our biology and what family we belong to. So we need to understand who we are in order to understand how these other animals interact with the world and how differently they perceive the world.
I really like the way you positioned humans as, and because we are primates, and I think sometimes we neglect to acknowledge that, and it does shape us. Biology does shape us, and the ways in which we move and interact, and the kind of blind spots we have, and the ways, the things that we can see and do really, really well, and the things that we can't see. And I really, more and more, I'm kind of enjoying this focus on smell and urine and kind of the signposting that's going on that we're completely oblivious to. Like there are other animals living amongst us and doing a whole host of things. And just because I don't know, when we talk about human language, we have a tendency of saying, well, other animals don't speak, so they're not as intelligent, so they're not as impressive, or they're not as worth paying attention to because they don't speak. But actually, a whole host of animals are speaking to one another without making any sound and disturbing others in a way that's very efficient. They're telling them how I feel, what my state is, and we can't understand them. So, like, I think it's really interesting because that is a form of speaking. It's a form of communication, of avoiding conflict. It's really cool.
Yeah, no, I think that invisible world is really interesting. You know, I mean, the rangers where I live will say, you know, well, you can smell koalas. You know when there's koalas in the area, you can smell them. And once you're tuned into that, then yes, you can smell when there's been a koala moving through an area. That's a very low level of communication, but you know, you can pick up on it. So and it does, you know, you suddenly start to go, oh, well, you have a look for the koala and you see where it is. And so it does change your perception. And I think that issue of judging other animals by our own, what we do well, I think that really, it impacts on how we see social behavior. And it also impacts on how we see intelligence. So koalas are often said to be very dumb. And this is something that is said about marsupials generally, which is pretty much it's very much a Northern Hemisphere bias, I think. You know, we tend to think the animals that we're familiar with and that we've grown up with are better than the ones from somewhere else. And it's also a little bit of a colonialism coming through in that too. You know, it's a justification for being able to take over countries because they're not as good as we can improve them. So there's a lot of things to unpack in that. But the issue of how intelligent an animal is, you know, is often packed in around how, like, do they do things like we do? Do they have the same skill set that we have? Do they have complex social behaviors? Do they live in groups? Do they cooperate? Do they use tools? Do they problem solve? Do they have language, the same sort of language as us? And that's all well and good, but it's not. I don't actually think it's a very interesting question. My interest in is how does this animal use its particular cognitive skills to adapt itself to the world? To me, intelligence is a way of responding to environmental change. So it's a question of behavioural flexibility, of being able to adapt to new circumstances. And koalas are actually able to adapt quite readily to new environments. We have koalas in the Adelaide Hills are currently moving down into the city, so which is quite remarkable for a species that's highly adapted to eucalypt forests. They're actually moving into the parklands, they're moving along river systems and learning to live in very human modified environments, which is a really interesting behavior and a very recent one, and it doesn't happen in any of the other cities. So there's lots of interesting things going on that we don't give them credit for because they don't look and sound and behave like us.
I like that definition a lot. And in preparation for this, I was reading a little bit more on, you know, like I think I looked at Britannica. I think it was Britannica kind of about marsupials and koalas. And one sentence that kind of stuck out to me was, oh, they're not, it was something along the lines of they're not social because they don't have leaders. And I thought, wow, that's a very bizarre way to think about social, because surely, and then I think it was something like, oh, kangaroo mobs, while they're known to kind of like be together, they're not social because there isn't like a hierarchy. And I was like, whoa, I don't think they use the word hierarchy, but they definitely use the word leader. And I thought, one, calling a whole bunch of kangaroos together a mob just seems, it seems like it's got a bias built in there already. And two, the idea that you can only be social or have a social group if there's like one standout leader seems to speak exactly to what you're saying. I also like your definition because the idea of adaptability, we like to think of ourselves as being super adaptable, and we can be. We can be, and we've shown ourselves to be adaptable in a remarkable number of environments, but we've also shown ourselves to be incredibly stubborn and not willing to change some of our behaviors that need to change to help animals and to help everyone else who's living on the planet. So we're nearing the end of the show now, where I'll give you a spot of time to read a quote. But before we get to that, maybe we could just speak a little bit about some of the challenges that are facing koalas. So they are adaptable. They've been around for a long time. But anyone who was watching the news, you know, in 2019, all of a sudden became very aware that koalas are facing massive threats because of fires. What happened there with the fire and koalas, and how are wildlife in general doing in kind of Australia in response to some of these new climate change issues?
Look, Australia has a really unfortunate reputation of having the highest level of mammal extinctions in the world, which is, to be fair, is caused by an unfortunate confluence of events, I guess. Firstly, that we're a continental landmass, so we have a very high level of biodiversity, so we've got a lot of different species. And secondly, because we were a very isolated and relatively recently colonized country, so those species have been removed and haven't had to face a lot of pressures from other species before, and that's happened relatively recently. So in the last 200 years, it's had a devastating impact with the arrival of a whole heap of new species that disrupt the ecology. So in effect, it's just happened more recently here. Those things would have happened elsewhere as well, but they just happened over a longer time frame, so we didn't notice it quite so much. Having said that, though, obviously we suffer from the same things as most places with, you know, massive deforestation. And the one thing koalas do need is a big forest. They need very, very big forests. And we have removed a lot of the forest cover, and we've particularly removed the favorite forest and the most important forest for koalas. So, you know, koalas, like anything else, they like tasty, healthy eucalypts that are very well fed and well watered. So we tend to clear the land along the rivers, which is the prime arable farming land. And when we remove those forests, we remove the core habitat for koalas and a lot of other Australian mammals. So they're the most diverse areas. They're the forests that their animals typically breed in. Even though they can live in the other forests, those river forests are the most important habitat for them. So losing the forest has been a big issue, and fragmenting the forest so they can't move between different habitats. That has a major interaction with fire. As you mentioned, we do have a lot of fires in Australia, and most wildlife and is in a way adapted to fires. Obviously, on an individual level, fires are horrible and devastating, but on a species level, most animals and plants are adapted to those fires. But when you have fragmented forest habitats, the impact of fire is much more devastating. So, for example, a couple of years ago, we had a fire that burnt through the bushland reserve behind my property, and it burnt right up to the edge of my property. And that entire bushland reserve was devastated in one hit by that fire. So the entire reserve was pretty much burnt. Now that reserve will recover, but in the meantime, there's not many other places for plants and, you know, for animals to go, the ones that left the area, or to recolonize the bushland from. So there's no reserves for wildlife to come from. So those kinds of actions can result in extinction, localized extinctions, and that's probably happened to koalas in the past. So they used to be found in Western Australia and they went extinct there. They used to be found in South Australia, they went extinct here. They've since recolonized South Australia, but they could easily be wiped out in small fragmented habitats. So, and that's what's happening on the East Coast in particular, where they are also suffering from a pretty fatal combination of disease that's also probably also being promoted by those fragmented habitats. So the koalas are all stuck in one area, disease becomes an even bigger problem for them, spreading through the population. They can't go anywhere else. if they go extinct in those fragments, they can't recolonize those areas. So the increasing frequency and severity of fires through climate change is likely to have a significant and substantial impact on koalas, and that's why they are struggling so much, particularly on the East Coast.
Wow, and I know that you mentioned because they've got this really well-adapted ability to kind of eat eucalyptus leaves, this makes treating some of these diseases when they hit koalas particularly devastating because they're also resistant to toxins. So yes, it is serious business, I think, I think fragmentation of habitat is, yeah, and I think it comes from many, many spaces. I was speaking to Gladys Kalema-Zikusoka, who works with mountain gorillas in Uganda, and they're actually having an uptick in the mountain gorilla population, which is great. It's the only population that's really, you know, thriving and doing well. But now they've reached a wall where they say, okay, but now at some point your population is going to get bigger. You know, you do all these conservation efforts without thinking a little bit further in advance. So you want to help populations grow. And when they do grow, even when there isn't devastation, not having spaces for them to grow into, not actually having dedicated, connected spaces is a real oversight. So these kinds of corridors are really essential, not only to, I think, mitigating climate change, but also to, like, literally just leaving some space for others alone, I think is quite important.
Yeah. I think that, you know, we haven't actually managed yet to stop destroying the forests, and we still have, even though native vegetation in Australia is meant to be protected, there are so many loopholes that, you know, mining's exempt, agriculture's exempt, forestry's exempt. So we've got so many loopholes that we are still, that the states that are having the trouble with koalas are the states that still allow land clearance. So I don't think that's a coincidence. But we actually need to be moving beyond stopping land clearance of native vegetation towards regenerating and expanding the existing forest area. So we've removed, I think we've only got 10% native vegetation where I live, and we really need to be at 30% to be in any way sustainable and not to lose more species to extinction over the next few decades. So, you know, it's a big job, and we also need to be looking at how we can make our habitat, our cities and our suburbs more sustainable for environment. And it's one of the good news stories for koalas is that they're demonstrating that they're quite happy to live in our cities if we make them a little bit more livable for everything. And we need to stop chopping down the trees that are still in the cities and start making sure we're growing new ones, because they carry a whole wealth of wildlife that we could successfully live with if we just try a little bit harder.
I don't think you could have said it any better. Cities are the fastest growing, I think, ecology in the world. And unless we start treating them as multi-species spaces that don't only serve humans, I think we're in for trouble. So I agree. Cities offer a range of kind of exciting opportunities to better locate and help and live with animals. But we need better policies and better planning to do that. Okay, otherwise I'm going to talk to you forever about these incredible, amazing animals. And before I do that, because I know it's early for you and the sun has just like come up over the course, listeners won't know this, but over the course of the interview we started and it was like black for Danielle in the background, and it's just gotten brighter and brighter because it was just gone 6 a.m. when we started talking. So do you have a quote ready for us?
Yes, I do. Okay, so I just want to read a little section from towards the end of the book, just thinking about the, you know, the status of koalas and where they've come from and where they're going. Over the course of their evolutionary history, koalas have responded to climate change, disease, changing forests, increasing aridity, predation and hunting, and they have survived. But the Black Summer fires prove just how easy it is to lose a huge number of koalas in just a few months. It's a perfect storm for catastrophic extinction. No matter how resilient they are, I'm not sure how well they are going to cope with all the threats they are currently facing, nor with the speed with which they are intensifying. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure how well we're going to cope as a species either.
Well said. And I think that really just encapsulates some of our conversation there, that there is time to change and that time is now. So thank you, Thank you so much for a really insightful and interesting conversation. I've learned so much from you about koalas today. Before we say goodbye, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're working on now? And if folks are interested in learning more about your work, where they could reach out to you or get in touch?
Yes, well, I'm certainly happy for people to reach out through social media or on my website at danielleclode.com.au. And I'm having a little bit of a break this year, just looking at seeing what comes up. I think climate change is such a big issue, and environmental change. It's something that has always been at the heart of what I write about. But trying to work out what a direct, you know, more direct way of addressing those issues in through stories and through narrative approaches. I'm kind of interested in looking for ways of presenting solutions in a way that people can relate to, I think. So I'm not quite sure what I'm going to be working on, but that's the kind of general field I'm interested in.
I think that's so important, because we tend to focus, we know what's wrong now. We need to kind of start coming up with ways to imagine a different tomorrow. And I think some of the work you're doing in this book by trying to just actually get koala's story out there is part of that imaginary work. So thank you so much. I'll make sure that I put your details up on the show notes as well. But have a wonderful day, and thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you once again to Daniel Claude for being an amazing guest, and to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this episode. Thank you too to Jeremy John for the logo and Gordon Clark for the bed music. And a final thank you to Christian Mentz for editing this episode. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hertenfelder.
For more great iRule podcasts, visit iRulePod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.